Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Again, we begin our show with the voice of Colonel Vindman as he was testifying in the fall of 2019 before the impeachment hearing. You will hear that voice every single day between now and November of 2020. I want you to remember his words as you go into the voting booth or vote by mail or vote absentee or however you can exercise the franchise. Remember Colonel Vindman, and frankly, remember Wisconsin. Now the voice of Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
If it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report. Scott Braddock is also the voice of Texas. He's also the dean of the Austin Press Corps. I am now threading Texas into almost every conversation I am having, whether it's on WGBH, whether it's talking to reporters from Sinclair News, whether it's talking to reporters from CNN. So in a lot of ways, you've really sort of expanded my horizon and also made me understand really sort of the interesting politics that are being played in different parts of the country. And in Texas, it's especially important because people are correct. As the future goes, it will be based on sort of the realities of politics in Texas.
Sure. So you talk to everyone. I think you have the same philosophy I do, which is, look, I'm me no matter who I'm talking to, no matter
exactly.
where I go. And I don't have a problem. Somebody said, you know, you appear on this crazy liberal show, Arnie Arneson. Somebody from Houston was saying this. Mm-hmm. So they listened to you on KPFT. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, do I sound any different from when I'm on the conservative shows in Dallas or Lubbock? No, I'm here to give people information.
Exactly right.
And people are just now figuring out that I have a point of view. Well, they're probably being paid too much.
Well, let me just say something. So I've been doing Sinclair News now for the last year and a half, basically mm-hmm. since the beginning of the sort of interesting primary season. And when he first called me, I'm a little surprised. And then I just said, if you don't accurately report what I say, uh-huh. I will never not only not speak to you again, but I'll make sure everyone understands. And he has been incredible. Not good. Incredible. So I am more than willing to do that. I'm on Fox News every couple of weeks Sunday. So I here's my point. My point is I will always speak.
With that guy who can never say your name.
And I will also make sure that I will correct the record if they say something that was inaccurate. And that's what I do. Anyway, on that note, let's talk a little bit about your governor, because apparently mm-hmm. he was saying things that were not necessarily being said in public, mm-hmm. but people have reported on it. So what did Governor Abbott do?
We reported on it. This was an exclusive at quorumreport.com, and it ended up everywhere, Arnie. It was in the New York Times and Newsweek and all over the place. I thought we were just doing the normal thing that we do here. So as this pandemic has been playing out, I've been having private conference calls with lawmakers, with members of the Texas House, the Texas Senate, and our congressional delegation. And at first, Arnie, I was sort of giving them a pass because, look, it's a global pandemic. People are learning in real time how to respond to this and how to run government, you know, amid a situation like this. And how else are you going to get all of the 181 members of the Texas legislature and congressional members, you know, together for a conversation? Of course, they have these conference calls, but they've been going on now for quite some time. And some of the things that are being said on these calls should be said in public. These are private conference calls. And I had made the observation a couple of weeks ago that a lot of the things that are being said are things that ought to be said in open public hearings, in interim hearings of the legislature. And somebody said, well, Scott, a lot of these conference calls are kind of boring and the governor drones on or staffers drone on or agency people are droning on. And, you know, who wants to listen to all that? And I said, are you kidding me? Do you have any idea how many hearings of the legislature I've sat through that went on for hours and hours? And they might have been, you know, eye-rollingly, eye-glazing, overly boring. And yet, you have reporters, journalists listening to this. You have members of the legislature listening to this because there will be something that is said that is important, you know, in the midst of these conversations. They're making decisions about our lives and our livelihoods, mm-hmm. and they're doing it in private. They're, you know, this is all being done from the governor's administration rather than being done through a legislative process. So that's frustrating. So of course, we do what we do at the Quorum Report, and I've been reporting out what's being said on these calls, and I'll do that any way that I can. They may have these conference calls, and then I simply talk to lawmakers who were on the calls, or you know, text messages with those folks, or talk to staffers, try to piece together what the conversations were. In this instance, someone on the call, and there are probably hundreds of people on the call, Arnie, because as I mentioned, it's members of the legislature, their staffers, congressional members, and their staffers as well. Somebody had recorded the phone call and sent us a piece of it, about 3 minutes worth, which you can hear at quorumreport.com. And what the governor said is something that probably shouldn't surprise people, but it's something he should say in public. Remember, it was more than a week ago. The governor had said he was going to open up Texas and start to restart business all over the great state of 254 counties. And they were going to allow for restaurants to open at decreased capacity at 25%, hopefully to ramp up to 50% and 75% beyond that. Gyms and hair salons, which we will talk about in just a minute, those would have to stay closed for now. And the governor talked about the idea publicly, and I want to make the distinction here. Publicly, he said, it's just common sense that as we ramp up testing, as there's more testing in the field, we're going to see increased cases that are identified of COVID-19. Okay. And that can be true, right? And that is true. That's not what he said in private to lawmakers on the private conference call. What he said, I'm going to paraphrase it first, then I'm going to read you the quote. The paraphrase version is he said that as business opens, there will be more cases of COVID-19 because businesses are opening and people are around each other more than they are when they're stuck at their homes, right? And that makes sense too. That's common sense as well. Here's the actual quote. He said, quote, it's almost ipso facto. The more that you have people out there, the greater the possibility there is for transmission. He was responding to what appeared to be a straightforward question from a lawmaker or a staffer about the correlation between reopening business and the spread of COVID-19. Someone on the call had simply asked, how do we know that we won't have more cases of this as we open up? And his answer is that we do know that we will, which is what he should say in public. I heard privately from Republicans, lawmakers, and from some lobbyists as well who are Republicans, who said, why didn't he just say that when he was laying out the original plan to open Texas, to set the expectation for people that you're going to see more cases because we're choosing to open up? Would that sound too much like Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick when he was on Fox News Channel more than a month ago saying that seniors ought to maybe be willing to sacrifice their lives in exchange for a robust economy? You know, that Governor Cuomo in New York has talked about the idea that you shouldn't have to choose between saving lives and having a robust economy. But the fact of the matter is the governor's acknowledging here that there is a choice being made. More people will potentially be hospitalized with it. More people will potentially die from it because of the government decision to loosen restrictions. It's not because there's going to be more testing that you'll see an increase in the numbers. He's saying privately, it is the case that if we open up Texas, you're going to have more cases of this and potentially more deaths. And he should be honest with people. Did you see where Chris Christie was on the CNN podcast the other day?
And of course, I heard a little bit of it. Yeah.
And he's always been, a straight shooter, a blunt, speaker. And of course, he's more liberated than ever because he's not in public office. But he said, you know, as he pushes for the economy to be open, people will die. And the fact of the matter is, Arnie, that it seems like from President Trump down to governors like Greg Abbott, they want to kind of tell people that they can have everything, that they can have their cake and eat it too, that we can have the same kind of robust economy that we had before, and we can protect people from dying from COVID-19. And it seems to be from these comments that that's just not the case. I think this is an important point, Arnie. And the way we talk about these things matter because it informs the way people think about it. The way our leadership talks about it matters. The governor and the president, they keep framing this up like it's a war, like we're at war with a disease. There's a reason to use a term like war because wars have casualties, right?
Exactly.
It's a war That means get ready, everybody. We may see 100,000, 200,000 Americans dead as we try to battle this. If you think about it, a situation where people are more accepting of more casualties, rather than if you talked about it like what it actually is, which is a global public health catastrophe, and it should be thought of that way with the goal of saving lives. And if these folks want to frame it up as a war, well, then get ready, because we've all been drafted into the war, Arnie. By the way, that did not go well for presidents who tried it in the past, did it?
Let me just say something. What I think he is doing, and I think what Governor Abbott is doing, and what Chris Christie is doing, is they want to dull us to the death. They don't want us. They want us to almost think that the idea of 100,000, 120, that we stop focusing on the consequences of this pandemic, the consequences of the fail to test, the consequences of the failure of leadership, the idea that we're opening prematurely. They want us to just assume death. And if they can keep, in an interesting way, playing that drumbeat, of course this is the choice, of course this is the result, it gets them off the hook for not providing us with the kind of leadership, the kind of testing, the kind of public health response that we should be demanding. This is a plot. It is an absolute plot. Remember when Fauci and Birx came out with their 14 days, you need to see the numbers decline, yada, yada, yada. Not one state has met what Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx put out as sort of the standard for beginning to go from phase one to phase two or whatever the phases are. They haven't met them. So guess what? There is no standard. The only thing that we're told to accept is death. And that is the constant drumbeat. Now the question is, can what you say and what I say remind people that that is not acceptable? That is not acceptable. That is a cover for their failure to exercise sound leadership.
Well, and I think, Arnie, it's just a matter of being transparent with people. If that's the choice they're making, then they should be saying that. They should be saying that publicly, that that's the choice that they're making. And then people can decide whether they agree with it. Listen, I think there are a lot of people who, if they're leveled with and they said, look, this is the deal. We are taking increased risks, but we got to have an economy. We're entering a situation where things are starting to look like the Great Depression out there with all of the unemployment and people going hungry and folks who never had to ask for assistance before are having to visit the food bank and ask for a bag of groceries. Be honest with people. This is the choice that we're making, and let it go from there. But don't act as if people can have everything. Don't act as if we can just restart the economy and there is no consequence for that, because guess what? All of the science points to the fact that there will be consequences for that, and it will lead to increased cases of this and potentially way more death.
Okay, let me just add one more thing and then we can move on to the next topic, and that's this, is that we did an amazing interview the other day about the idea that McConnell and Trump and a lot of the governors, they want to limit the liability of companies because of COVID-19, okay? They want to just, basically the idea is you're making a choice. Here's part of the problem with this sort of death march and this sort of drumbeat that you know we should accept these deaths, is that it then not only takes the leaders off the hook, it also takes the employers off the hook. That means now that employers can be less rigid in making sure that there is social distancing, in making sure that there's PPEs, in making sure that they wipe stuff down. Because if we start accepting that death is part of the definition of this economy, then we basically said to them, you have no responsibility to protect your workers, and you have less responsibility to protect your customers. That can't be acceptable either. We have to be vigilant. Yes, I understand the pandemic is a problem and we haven't solved it yet. Yes, there will be horrific consequences, but that doesn't mean that you don't exercise some kind of fiduciary responsibility to your employees and to the public to make sure you protect them as reasonable as possible. But that has to happen. And that's my concern about what Abbott is saying, you know, quietly, and what Trump is saying actually loudly, and what you're hearing from Chris Christie, just accept the fact that death is going to happen. Well, that doesn't get you off the hook for making sure you try to prevent it. Make sense?
I'm going to just agree.
Okay, agree. All right. Anyway, so
makes sense.
It just bothers me that this is a way to, it's sort of a get off the hook. And that I don't want people off the hook. I want them to be vigilant. And that's important, both from an employer standpoint as well as a public official standpoint. So anyway. All right, so talk to me a little bit about
they're trying to get off the hook, but they should be transparent. This hairdresser in Dallas, this is an interesting situation, Arnie. So just last week, the governor of Texas and the attorney general officials with the idea that there would be prosecutions in Texas if the orders from Governor Abbott to not open certain businesses were not followed. And the governor had not yet given the green light for hair salons to be open in Texas. This has been a big question. You know, in Georgia, they went full speed toward hair salons and nail salons being open. The people could go get
massage
a haircut
parlors.
And all that. Well, businesses where people touch you. That's the short version. Any business where to get service, you are touched by the employees. They said no to that so far. You know, the whole idea when you're talking about transmission of a virus is the idea that you can have social distancing or physical distancing, keep people 6 feet away from each other and all of that. Well, they can't stay away from you if they're cutting your hair or doing your nails. They have to touch you. And so the governor's original plan had said that the businesses where you're not touched, like restaurants, those can be open, but at decreased capacity. And, you know, in 18 days, we'll come back and look at whether or not we've seen a spike in cases. And at that point, we will, you know, evaluate whether or not businesses like hair salons can open. Well, in the meantime, there's a woman in Dallas who runs a hair salon there who apparently is pretty connected to the activist class of the right wing of the Republican Party in Dallas-Fort Worth. And she had said she was going to continue to have her hair salon open. And she was arrested and she was put in jail for 7 days for violating the governor's order. The governor's order says you can't have those open just yet. The judge in Dallas County, a Democrat, gave her an option, or you can watch the video if you Google it. The judge said, if you will apologize and just close the shop, I'll let you go. You won't have to be in jail. She said, no. She said, there's nothing selfish about me or my employees working to feed our families, and people can debate that if they want to. But this is in violation of the governor's order. The local officials are enforcing the governor's order. And just last week in Montgomery County, Texas, down in the Houston area, the county judge there had said that he was going to allow for hair salons to open because he thought that the governor's order was too vague. And both the governor and the attorney general had told that county judge, no, the governor's order is enforceable and you need to keep those businesses closed in your county. Otherwise, there could be prosecutions. That was just a week ago. In the meantime, conservative lawmakers and conservative activists rallied around this hair salon owner in Dallas and said that this is government overreach, this is tyranny and all of that. And the governor, in just the last 24 hours, changed his tune. He said that she should not be locked up. The attorney general called for the immediate release of this hair salon owner in Dallas. And it really has become a full-on culture war, once again, here in Texas. If you didn't think that a pandemic could turn into a culture war, then welcome to Texas. Stay a while. We're glad to have you. It's not new to see hypocrisy in politics, Arnie, but the speed at which this happened, people have whiplash. Because as I said, just last week, the governor was saying no. Now, in the meantime, not only did the governor change his tune about that woman, but the governor had originally laid out a timeline that said he wasn't even going to look at opening hair salons until May 18th. As I'm talking to you, it's May 7th. And on Monday of this week, a few days ago, the governor went ahead and said that this Friday, tomorrow, as the show is airing, that hair salons can open across Texas. And people are divided about whether that can happen. But this was the timeline of this, Arnie. The comments that we just reported on from the governor, where he had said, if you know the private comments, the private comments that he said, in which he said that you will have more transmission of the disease if people are out there, that was reported on the afternoon, a couple of hours before the governor went ahead and folded on this and said that hair salons and barbershops and other businesses can go ahead and open this Friday. While the governor says that this is driven by and his decisions are driven by data and doctors, that's been the line that he continues to set to repeat. It doesn't seem to be the case. I mean, he had laid out a much slower timeline for this. And as the political heat was turned up because of this, folks rallying around this hair salon owner in Dallas, he went ahead and folded and said, we're going to go ahead and let those businesses be open. In the meantime, this woman was in jail for 7 days. That was the sentence. Republican activists had asked that the governor pardon her, which I don't even know that the process for pardoning someone can even happen within 7 days. And the governor probably would not do that. He told a conservative radio talk show host in Dallas yesterday that he was pretty certain that this woman from Dallas, Shelley Luther, would be back on the job by Friday, but not via a pardon. So I'm not exactly sure how that's going to happen, but apparently some pressure is being applied to spring her out of jail. And look, Arnie, there's been debate about whether the governor's going too far with his executive orders and trying to keep Texans safe from this disease. But these are the same people who are always, and you've heard it for years, screaming about rule of law, rule of law. The rules for have to be for everybody or there are no rules. This woman in Dallas is getting special dispensation. There was also a case down in South Texas, and there were two women in Laredo who were providing beautician services out of their homes. There was a sting operation. They were arrested in South Texas. I didn't hear any outcry from Republican leadership about that. It only seems to be about this woman in Dallas who, as I mentioned, has been pretty plugged into the conservative activist class in Dallas-Fort Worth.
So has anyone asked him, why should we follow any of your orders?
That is exactly the right question.
Right, exactly.
Why would you do anything?
Exactly.
I should mention there were two Republican members of the legislature. Two Republican members of the legislature who went ahead and had their hair cut in Montgomery County over the weekend in defiance of the governor's order. They got a professional haircut. It was on camera. It was on social media and I guess on television as well in the Houston market. And right after that, the governor says, well, I'm going to go ahead and open up the barbershops again. Why would anybody follow the order? It's a dangerous game because we're talking about people's lives and their livelihoods too. There are a lot of beauticians across the state who are not doing this, you know, who are staying home and aren't operating because the governor had said they should not operate. And I would say one thing about civil disobedience, Arnie. We know this from years of watching the civil rights movement and everything else. When you engage in civil disobedience, any of those who marched with Dr. Martin Luther King, and people always want to compare folks like the salon owner in Dallas to somebody like Rosa Parks, which is a bit of a stretch. But any of those folks would tell you that anytime they engaged in civil disobedience, guess what? There were consequences for that. They went to jail. They went to jail. A lot of times I would talk to some of the folks who engaged in that. They would say they knew they were going to march in the morning and they'd be in jail that night because they knew there were consequences for that, but they were doing the right thing. What we see these days with a lot of this stuff is people want to engage in civil disobedience, but they're not interested in the consequences that go along with it.
I would love to ask Governor Abbott, so what's your leadership style? I mean, it just sounds like I'm going to throw it out there. I'm not going to follow through. I'm going to cave as soon as, you know, the right buttons are pushed. So therefore, there is no guidance from your order. Therefore, you know that depending on how connected or how connected they are to even the conservative media, that you know he will cave. I need to feel secure in knowing that he's doing something to protect all of us, but it appears that all of us get thrown under the bus as soon as someone like this hairdresser knows exactly who to talk to in order to say that the standard now evaporates. And I'm going to ask the governor, are you here to protect her or are you here to protect us? Does Texas matter, Governor Abbott? Does Texas matter? Or do these people matter who apparently seem to intimidate you and you are willing to cave? That is not leadership. You know, this is someone who lacks a spine. And frankly, I elected you to protect Texas, not to protect them alone.
Either the rules apply to everybody or they don't apply to anybody. And that's what we have seen in this case. The governor has backed off of the rules that he put out there. And I would say one other thing about this, Arnie. How many criminal defendants would jump at the chance if a judge said, all you have to do is say you're sorry and stop doing that thing, then you can go free? And she says she wouldn't do it. A lot of folks have commented on this saying that it seems like a real situation of someone who's very privileged, to be able to do, to be in the situation they're in.
Well, she was not only privileged, but she was well connected to places where there's an echo chamber for her behavior. She knew exactly where to go. And so this wasn't about her own personal sort of decision-making. It was, I think, orchestrated to make sure that it would go up the food chain, to make sure that there would be this response. And you got exactly the response you've got. Governor Abbott caved. Governor Abbott caved. That shows his lack of leadership. It shows his lack of spine. And then the question is, if you can do this with this order, tell me what I can do with your next order, Governor. Because it apparently is that people don't have to follow them because you know you won't follow them. He didn't follow his own order.
Right. There's been a lot of question about whether the governor even has the authority in Texas to order these sorts of things. But for the most part, Texans have been complying because I think they understand it's a public health crisis and, you know, it's unprecedented. And there are certain things that they're going to have to do to keep everybody safe and to look out for each other, Texans helping Texans. But in this instance, the governor's the one who undermined himself.
Okay, I need to let Scott Braddock go. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report. But before I let you go, I just want to remind you that the question isn't, does he have the authority? Because that hasn't been challenged yet. What you know is he's exercising the authority. She basically sort of said, screw you to that authority, and he caved. I think someone should challenge him, does he have the authority? That's a very different conversation. But unfortunately, that's not where we are. People are assuming that he does. They're actually acting upon that. The only person who doesn't think he has the authority is him. It's him. Anyway, Scott Braddock, thank you so much for joining us. It's the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around for Current Cast, and we'll be right back.
Stormwater and sewage on this Current Cast. In many parts of Pittsburgh, stormwater and sewage are carried in the same pipes. So during heavy rain, the system can overflow and dump untreated sewage directly into the city's rivers.
As we get more and more rain, it just is an outdated way of managing the flow of stormwater, and it's just disgusting.
That's Stefan Bontrager of the nonprofit River Life. He says to better protect the rivers and people's health, the city is working to upgrade its aging infrastructure. Pittsburgh is also partnering with nonprofits and landowners to restore watersheds and plant rain gardens,
so that you can capture a lot of that storm water before it ever even hits the sewer system.
Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
The mothers, the fathers, the teachers that feed us.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. He's back again, our favorite, Dr. Politics, Stefan Schmidt, teaches political science at Iowa State. We've been doing this dog and pony show for over 20 years now, and we will continue to do it as long as both of us don't die because of COVID-19. There are so many issues, Stefan.
Arnie, can I wear this?
That's hilarious, everyone. Where did you get that?
We've had this for a year because we were painting and refinishing furniture.
Now, is that an N95 or is that like, that's like an N95 on steroids? I've never seen anything quite like it.
No, this is a 3M 2097.
Wow, it's unbelievable. I'm totally impressed. Anyway, since you can't see him, I should describe it. These little pink things on the side, it covers his nose. He looks like he's going to be an astronaut and go into outer space.
That's right.
There was an article that was posted yesterday morning. It was entitled, "The Senate Returns to Its Essential Work of Basically Doing Nothing." And they were having lunches, they were confirming ultra-conservative judges, and they were not abandoning the recovery. So I get it that Mitch McConnell and Nancy Pelosi agreed not to test everybody, that they, you know, they should come back, they shouldn't be doing work remotely. But this is kind of a joke, what Mitch McConnell was doing. What was he showing people? That what was important to him were judges, even as people are realizing that we have to address this pandemic and there needs to be some kind of fourth response. But that wasn't the raison d'etre for the return. It was once again to continue to pack the court with these sort of, you know, incompetent, you know, attorneys who basically probably are under the age of 40 that will be on the bench till my children die.
Well, the real problem is they really don't know what to do anymore. They've spent, you know, billions of dollars or moving into trillions. We cut taxes, so there is no reserve, no revenue flow. The economy is shut down. Nobody is getting any revenue. And what are you supposed to do? So the easiest thing to do is the default, which is to do what your supporters want you to do, and that is confirm conservative justices. And also, President Trump has been appointing his own team to take over things like the U.S. Post Office, which Trump hates for a variety of reasons. And, you know, the pandemic itself seems so daunting and impossible to deal with. You know, we don't have enough testing. We don't seem to be bringing more testing online. And so as opposed to, you know, Taiwan and Korea and other places, even the European countries, we seem to be sort of frozen in place. And I think Mitch McConnell is not a man of the 21st century in any case. And so I think he's just in shock.
Let me just read the language in this Slate article is just so powerful. He said, since he announced last week that the Senate would return to business, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's rhetoric has been Churchillian in its resolve to carry on the nation's vital work, as if this was vital work, in the face of a public menace. Let me quote McConnell. "The Senate will shift out of the ranks of those Americans who are working remotely," McConnell said, "and into the ranks of the Americans working in essential sectors who are listening to expert guidance and modifying their routines, but ultimately continuing to man their posts to keep this country running." These are the guys that like rarely show up in Washington anyway, up until now, the pandemic. And then he goes on to say, "It is essential that brave healthcare workers, grocery store workers, truck drivers, and many other Americans continue to carefully show up for work. Then if it's essential for them, then it is essential for the US senators carefully to show up ourselves and support them." Oh my God, what an act of patriotism. Oh my God, send him to war. Actually, you know where I want Mitch McConnell to go? I want him to go to a meat packing facility and I want him to start cutting pork because I want him to experience what those real frontline workers are experiencing other than what he is experiencing, which is still being so damn protected. And frankly, the kind of junk they're doing right now in the US Senate that isn't about the pandemic could easily be done via Zoom. I am sorry. This is garbage. This is not patriotism. This is a way for him to create the illusion of somehow doing, you know, the people's work when actually what he's doing is a conservative agenda.
Well, you know, frankly, the Democrats have also surrendered. You know, they understand that they don't have a solution. We don't have enough, basically, here in Iowa, we have a massive crisis because the packing industry, the slaughterhouse industry, as I call it, which it should be called, is such a terrible place when a pandemic erupts.
Let's continue by talking about what's happening in the meatpacking facilities, because I think it's really important for people to understand that this has huge consequences for the economy, but that it also has huge consequences because these people live in the community, and if every one of them has got COVID-19, they're bringing it all home.
Well, and they're going, you know, in Iowa, the governor has these, you know, places where, you know, you have to shelter at home and so on, depending on how many people tested positive or are dying. And the problem is people move back and forth between these zones. So, you know, it's not, you know, you're not isolated in a county. You get in your car, you drive to the next county. So the workers working in these meat packing plants or slaughterhouses, they drive home, they drive to the next county and go to the grocery store. And so once they're infected with this, it's difficult to contain it. And we don't know how to do it. We have this pressure by people carrying firearms. In Iowa, there haven't been any protests, but I know there have been in New Hampshire and other states to reopen everything up. You hear people saying, well, if I catch it, I'm going to recover from it. I'm a healthy person, so I don't care. I need to get back to work. And so there is really this incredible challenge between Americans who no longer can tolerate being at home and not having an income, and the whole idea of how to contain this virus and this crisis. We've never gone through this before. Even in the Spanish flu pandemic, I think it was less daunting than this. So I think just, you know, we just have to sort of say we wish we had more leadership. We wish we had more sanity. And we wish we had a vaccine, which we're not going to have for a long time.
So I'm kind of curious about Iowa and its internet connectivity. And there was a series of articles, Christian Science Monitor did it, and they were talking about rural communities beginning to really panic. And the reason they're going to be beginning to panic, they've always complained about the fact that there is this gap between who has access to the internet and high-speed internet and who does not. Now this access issue is becoming even more important. As we are shutting down public education, as we are shutting down higher education, now the internet isn't about being on Facebook. It isn't about being able to buy from Amazon. It isn't about being able to talk to your relatives, you know, through social media, because you can still, you know, you can still be a farmer maybe, or maybe you can still go to the grocery store, but now it's about education. So what you've got now is this real gap, because certain parts of the state, certain parts of the country are not going to be able to educate their kids in the same way as people that are more connected to the internet, let alone have access to the kind of high-speed internet or computers. And again, that's a wealth issue. So you've got the wealth dichotomy, and then you've got the rural-urban dichotomy of who has actual access to the internet. What is your governor in Iowa suggesting? I saw that the folks in Vermont, you know what they're doing? They're going to look at the funds that the governor, that they were given from the feds from COVID-19, and they're thinking about using those COVID-19 funds to ensure that every single Vermonter has access to the internet, because now it truly is a necessity and a result of COVID-19, because how the hell are they going to educate their kids, let alone function at all? It is not just about a luxury. It's about now their kids' right to a public education.
Well, it certainly is. I don't have high-speed internet. I have a little in rural Iowa. No one wants to put a fiber optic line to a farmhouse that's sitting way the hell in the middle of nowhere because it's not effective financially. Now, you know, a lot of people have satellite internet access, which is pretty good. And the truth of the matter is, you just have to adapt. I mean, when I was a kid, there was no internet. And when there were riots and violence in Colombia, where I grew up, and the schools were shut because nobody was allowed out. My parents taught me. You know, my parents read to me. My parents tried to do whatever math we did in those days, which was pretty rudimentary. My dad subscribed to National Geographic and Time magazine, which were wonderful sources of history, of, you know, anthropology, of geography, geology. And my parents spent a lot of time teaching me. And I think we've become so dependent on schooling as opposed to education. And schooling is going to school. Education is learning something. I met a guy when I was doing some research back when I was in grad school in Colombia, who grew up in a small town, never went beyond the fifth or sixth grade, but was a passionate learner and was now running in charge of a library in my hometown. He had no education. He never went to college or anything, but he knew more than I did because he read and studied and was a passionate learner. So we've given up on that.
I'm just going to stop you. Can you explain to people the background of your father and your mother, what kind of degrees they had, that they were able to stay home with you? Because there's not only a situation where there's a lack of access to the internet, and we're telling teachers they're supposed to be teaching remotely, but a lot of kids are living in areas where their parents may not have the academic skill set to be able to educate you in the way that you are being educated, number one. Number two, their parents may still be essential workers and have to go to work. So who's taking care of the kids and who's teaching little Mary and little Johnny? And I mean, so you've got all these, and then you've got, again, the haves, the kids that have parents like yours, in addition to which they have the highest quality internet access. They have teachers who can find them. And these kids now have every checkbox that says inequity, that says you are not going to have access to a quality public education because now everything is working against you. And they're literally saying that lots of kids are disappearing from the academic roles because they haven't ever checked in.
Well, I hate to say this, but I've been reading a lot about it. And a lot of those kids really never had a high quality education before this. Their schools were underfunded. Their neighborhoods are filled with violence and drugs, and there are no family structures in a lot of communities where kids only have a grandparent that's taking care of them because the parents either have died or have left or are dysfunctional. We're now seeing all the really raw and terrible conditions of a lot of people in this country. And I think it's just made us more aware of it. I don't think it's materially changed much, frankly, Arnie.
Well, it's interesting. So I was talking to some Vermonters about this plan to use the COVID-19 funds. And so they were talking not only about the inequity of, you know, the haves and the have-nots when it comes to internet access and the issue of public education, but they also saw doing this was also a recovery plan. And here's what was so interesting. They were saying that they're beginning to notice that there is actually even an uptick in housing acquisition in places like Vermont and New Hampshire, because people are suddenly realizing, do I want to be in a major urban area, or do I want to be someplace where there's less density? Because of course, because of the pandemic, we're realizing that density actually is a great way of transmission. And so what they're seeing by allowing this or by building in this internet access, it actually is a way of saying you can now move to rural Vermont, because not only will you be able to do your job remotely, your kids will still be able to go to school remotely, but you'll be safer physically remotely. And now it's both a response to the pandemic, but also an investment, sort of an economic development investment in a place that historically has been written off, because now there's new pressure for why people may want to live there, but they can't live there if they can't connect.
Well, I hate to say this, but urban concentration in Maine, Vermont, and New Hampshire, I mean, you don't have any urban concentrations. You have these little towns like Concord. They're not urban concentrations, you know. I mean, those are considered rural by people in New York or Chicago or other places.
And I'm not talking about people leaving Concord. I'm not talking about people leaving Portland. I am talking about people leaving Boston. So I'm going to give you a absolutely true story. I have a friend who is a social worker in New York City. She has been working in New York for 8 years. She and her entire department came down with COVID-19, okay? She's working in the public health sector. Everyone in her department got it, okay? For the first time ever in 8 years, she just made applications to Vermont, to New Hampshire, and to Maine to do social work. She is now talking about abandoning New York City. She went to NYU. She loves New York. But now, because of the pandemic, she is not sure that she wants to get on a subway, that she wants to have to travel in such a way. And this is a person who I thought would never leave. She's not talking about going from Concord, New Hampshire to Northern New Hampshire. She's talking about New York City coming to maybe Derry or Concord or frankly Berlin, New Hampshire. So I am telling you, we're going to see an interesting migration as a result of the pandemic as well. And then the question for these more rural areas is, how can you anticipate that migration? One, by improving your hospitals, but also by improving their ability to live there and still work. So it's fascinating, absolutely fascinating what this pandemic is doing.
Well, that's interesting, but I'm not sure that an internet connection adds a lot of value if you move from New York to New Hampshire, because you're going to probably soon be working face-to-face with people and not necessarily on the internet. You know, I mean, the internet, high-speed internet connection is wonderful for a lot of different things. I think a robust healthcare system would be a better investment, frankly.
I think so too. We're looking at a story from The Hill. And the story from The Hill said, openings may put Black workers at disproportionate COVID-19 risks. So what we see that Donald Trump knows, even though he's denying the numbers and he wants to make death acceptable because after all, we're all going to die anyway and we might as well sacrifice for the economy. And a lot of people right now are thinking that it's only people in nursing homes and people over the age of 65 that may kick the bucket. But what we also know is that a lot of people with underlying health conditions that come from places where they've been breathing polluted air, that they are also at incredible risk. And what we're talking about for the most part are not only poor people, a large number of Blacks and Hispanics. Do you think that Donald Trump is actually doing a calculus on here? Because he's assuming that those Blacks and Hispanics won't vote for him anyway. Therefore, their lives are expendable. And it actually may enhance his numbers in November. This man, to me, is so damn evil that everything is about his reelect. Everything is about wealth. And he sees these people not only as a detriment to his reelect in November, but if they go, he won't care.
Well, I mean, African-Americans and Latinos have had much higher mortality rates from all kinds of other illnesses.
Absolutely.
Long before the coronavirus struck. They have been low-income people, don't have health insurance often. If they live in communities where the community hospital is underfunded, you know, they always were at higher risk. And so now, again, I emphasize it now, that all is accentuated. We're even more concerned because the death rate is higher. Maybe before they weren't dying, but they were just getting terribly sick. The world is a different place in 2020 from what it was when I was a kid. And you asked about my parents. You know, my parents were not wealthy. My mother never had a college education. In those days, the mother stayed at home. So my mom was always at home. You know, and my father went to work in the optical business that he owned. So you always had essentially homes where there were adults all the time. There were grandparents. My grandmother was there. My mother was there. 2020 is a different situation. People have moved very often. They don't have any family nearby. Certainly no family can afford to have just one member working if they're working. So everybody is working, so everybody leaves, the adults leave in the morning. And the question of who's going to take care of the kids, much less be there to educate them, you know, is a critical sociological issue in 2020. We're living in a society where we're so used to the institutional support system. The school bus shows up, the kids get on the school bus and go to school, which allows the parents to go to work. If all of that collapses, we have to face a new, not just a political or healthcare reality, but a social reality, you know.
Let me just say something. So I am going to put it at the feet of the corporate community. And the reason I'm going to say that is when they decided to ship all those great manufacturing jobs, where mom could stay home in the 1950s, like Donna Reed. I think I think Donald Trump was referring to Donna Reed the other day. But the mom could stay home. Dad could actually earn a living that would buy a house, take care of a wife, take care of two kids, do all those things on one salary. Then starting in the 1970s, we saw those jobs disappear. We saw those incomes decline. But that didn't mean that your mortgage went down. It didn't mean it cost less to feed your family. It didn't mean that you didn't have to clothe your kids. So guess what happened? Mom had to go to work. Mom went to work, not necessarily because she wanted to or because of women's lib. She went to work in order to make sure the bills were paid. And now let's fast forward into 2020. In 2020, we have a browning of the society. The society is changing. A lot of white people, especially Donald Trump supporters, are very afraid of that because they've always been at the top of the mountain and now they're going to have to share the mountain. They don't want to do it. Donald Trump, it's interesting. You notice how pork meatpacking facilities became essential infrastructure. That's what he labeled as essential infrastructure. But we were begging him to create essential infrastructure to build ventilators. He wouldn't do it. When we were begging him to create essential infrastructure for being able to make the masks and the vials and everything else for the pandemic, he would not.
Right.
But to eat a damn pork chop, eat a hamburger, those are essential workers and essential infrastructure. Why? Because those people are expendable.
Well, I mean, the other problem, of course, is in a state like Iowa, if the meat processing industry collapses, the economy of the entire state collapses. I mean, our state, the farmers, the truckers, the grain providers, the veterinarians, pharmaceuticals, animal, you know, everything else. It is a pyramid that if it begins to crumble, the entire state crumbles. So it's in a sense, it is sort of critical infrastructure in that sense.
Well, but I get the financial aspect and the economic aspect, but isn't it interesting that he makes this essential that might be useful in Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa, but what is essential for the entire nation is to be able to respond to the pandemic. But the pandemic has never been an issue for him. The pandemic is just a sidebar. It is not something he cares about. It's something he has to navigate. And that's what, and I just want Iowa to reconsider something else. Maybe they should reconsider the fact that they've monopolized everything, that there are only a handful of meat processing plants. All the companies, all the farmers that grow pigs, they don't even own their damn pigs. It's owned by the monopoly. So I think this is also an opportunity for Iowa and Iowa farmers to say, do I want to be so wedded to this? Because maybe it's not good for my financial future.
My article is coming out on Monday on that.
Oh, perfect.
And I'll send it to you.
I love it. I love it, Stefan Schmidt. If it's Friday, it must be at the beginning, Scott Braddock. At the end, Stefan Schmidt. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Thank you so much for joining us, Stefan. I appreciate it.
Bye, Arnie. You've been there.